Brainstorm Brewery is brought to you by GatheringMagic.com and CoolStuffInc.com. Show your support.
Welcome, everyone, to a very special episode of Brainstorm Brewery. And I know you hear that it's a special episode every time I say welcome to Brainstorm Brewery, but really, this is a very special episode. We happen to shoot high, and we went to the top of the food chain, so we got you a very special guest. You know him as the director of R&D at Wizards of the Coast. We have Aaron Forsythe.
Hello.
Hello. How are you doing? Thank you for joining us. It's quite the honor. Glad that you're here.
No, it should be fun.
I agree, it should be, but we do it every week and it doesn't always.
If you say the same thing by the end of the cast, then we feel we accomplished that.
All right.
So what do you guys, tell us what are you guys doing out at headquarters for the journey into Nick's release weekend? How do you guys like commemorate new sets coming out?
We have a internal pre-release tournament. I think it's either Tuesday or Thursday night. I'll have to check my calendar. It starts at 4 o'clock, runs until 9. We fill up the whole downstairs floor with people playing. It's a great time. It's very casual. Kind of, play whoever you want to, whenever you want to. Which is a model that I really like for kind of low impact events. We're not waiting around for everybody in the room to finish before you get on to play the next person. And just play as many games as you want. Pizza, soda, and it's just a great time.
Yeah, these cards are all like old news to you guys. We're all excited about getting out to releasing it.
They were old, and they're so old now that when I look at them now, they feel new again. they've been put away and they've gathered dust. And now I'm like, oh, we made that. I forgot about that one. I was just looking through the player's guide today, and I was like, oh man, look at all these. I forgot these existed, but there they are.
So how often do you get to play normally on your weeks? And is the pre-release is your best time to play, or?
I mean, that's one of the few times I get to play with real cards, for sure. Internally, it's all stickers and Sharpies and whatever. And I get to do that 2-3 times a week if I'm lucky. There's weeks when I don't get to play at all anymore, which is a bummer. But I just played on Magic Online last week. We did the R&D Challenge, which was cool. So I try to carve out some time to keep playing. Before my skills erode too much.
Can you tell us what the R&D challenge is, briefly?
Yeah, before every Pro Tour, we run a Magic Online tournament that internal R&D people and some other people that work on Magic Online get to play in, because typically we're not allowed to play in events for prizes. And we run it in the constructed format of the Pro Tour just so we can take one last look at the format before we need to weigh in on the banned and restricted lists, and just to get some more input on what it's like playing on Magic Online. And we play 5-round event, and any packs that we would win get distributed to all the players that went undefeated in the event that are not from Wizards of the Coast. And this week, one guy went undefeated that did not work here, and he ended up with winning over 100 boosters.
Just oh, wow.
Nice. Yeah. Pretty good.
What kind of deck did you have? What were you playing?
I played a Minotaur deck. I did not do well. He did not get any boosters from me. We had a couple guys here go undefeated, and so we did pretty well this time. And that guy got lucky to walk off with a huge haul of stuff.
So are we safe to say there's going to be no Minotaurs banned in the upcoming ban?
No Minotaurs are banned. They're safe. I checked them out. They're going to be okay.
But there's a one drop now.
I know. I didn't get to play him. Sorely missed that, the Scarhide Brawler. I really would have to have that guy.
So we need to get some backstory on you. There is going to be some listeners that absolutely have no idea who you are and what does a director of R&D mean and everything.
Yeah, sure. Tell us, like, how did you get into Magic and start, because you were a very good player before you went to Wizards. So
right.
I want you to tell us about that.
Like most people, I bought some cards at a card store. A friend of mine told me about this game. He said it was something I might like. He was right. Bought some cards back in Revised. This was when I was still in college. Played with my roommate for a while. Quickly realized that there was more stuff to do than just play against my roommate. Hung out at the store. You know, learned the ins and outs of the game there. And there was a lot of good players in Pittsburgh. That's where I'm from. Some of them were making it to the Pro Tour, which was a big deal. And a guy named Randy Buehler, who played at Carnegie Mellon University, he actually went to the University of Pittsburgh. That's where I went. But he played Magic at CMU, won a Pro Tour. And I knew this guy from playing in local tournaments and whatever. And I thought, holy smokes, if this guy can win a Pro Tour, then heck, I can win a Pro Tour. So he kind of inspired me in that way to take it much more seriously. And I did. I got on the Pro Tour myself about a year later and made a couple of top eights. And meanwhile, just kind of meeting people, writing articles. I was editing a couple of websites, writing for other websites, you know, just like a lot of people do now. I got contacted by Wizards of the Coast, by Mark Rosewater specifically, before Daily MTG was launched. It was called, you know, MagicTheGathering.com. He said, we need someone to edit our site and do the content management for that. Would you like to move to Washington and do that? And I just had kind of a normal 9-to-5 working at a data processing plant, and I said, absolutely. So my wife and I moved to Washington, and I came to Wizards, and my first job here was doing the content management on the website, which is what Trick Jarrett does now here for us. So did that for a couple years, hung out in R&D in my spare time, was kind of give him some feedback on stuff, play some games with him. Eventually a position to open up in R&D, and Randy Buehler, who was the director of R&D at that point, asked me if I wanted to come work for him, and I said, absolutely, it sounds like a lot of fun. And slowly just been moving up the ladder in the department. I was a designer, I was a developer, I was a lead developer, and then once the directorship opened up, I took that job, and it's been many years. But I've been at the top for a while, and it's been great, and we've done great stuff, and the guys working for me are tremendous. What I do is I oversee all the card design, development, editing, creative, and the digital game design here at Wizards of the Coast. So all the stuff you know and love comes out of my group, and it's an awesome job.
So, I mean, tell us, when you know, you're getting into the game, you're starting to play, and then even after you go to work for Wizards, did you see yourself, you know, is this where you always wanted to get? Or, you know, is it just kind of, you took it as it came along?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't think this was ever necessarily a career goal for me. Just, I know that when I first saw Magic and first started playing Magic, I could tell that this was some revolutionary stuff. In fact, I'm reading the book that's called So Do You Wear a Cape. Have you, any of you guys read that? The ebook, the unofficial history of Magic the Gathering. I've been floating around on Twitter and stuff like that. So I was starting to read that, and it's talking about when Peter Adkison and all these original Wizards guys first saw and played Magic, just the reaction they had. And I kind of had that same reaction, like, this is so next level when in the gaming world that, you know, I just can't believe that everyone I know just doesn't want to do this all the time with all their time and money. and I kept trying to get all my friends into it as much as I could. I'm like, don't you see how awesome this is? Oh, my God, let's play this all day. You know, my roommates would be like, okay, sure, they'll play some. And then they drop in and out. And I'm like, why doesn't anyone get into this at the level that I did? And then, you know, as I got into the bigger local scene in the Pro Tour, I could see that there was this world full of people that were into it as much as I was. And I just kept, I don't know, I just kept parlaying that kind of passion. And I was always just like, okay, there's another step I can take. There's another step I can take. There's another step I can take. And ended up here. It was never some sort of nefarious plan or anything to end up in this seat. I like to think that I kind of have a good, well-rounded perspective on the game. I know what makes it work. I know what makes different kind of players work. And at the same time, I'm humble enough to take input from everybody around me on how to make it better and better. And I feel very fortunate. I know a lot of it was good timing, knowing the right people. Like I said, Randy Buehler kind of blazed a trail just in my vicinity that I could latch onto. And, you know, it's been a wild ride.
So I got to read all that in your article, the How I Got Here is a 3-part series.
Yep, on Daily MTG. That's why I wrote that when I first got the job.
Yep. Yeah, you sound very excited in the article. You can tell the passion's there. But you definitely mentioned that there was like a competitiveness between you and Randy Buehler. And now that you're director, you're in his chair. How do you see how you shaped Magic compared to how he shaped, and what direction are you going?
I mean, he did a lot of things right, for sure. I mean, the game was definitely in a weird place when he took it over. The power levels were all out of whack. I think there was a very insulated group working in R&D that didn't understand what the average player wanted. They were treating it like some kind of math problem. And, you know, stuff like Necropotence was fine to reprint and Strip Mine was fine to reprint, but Sarah Angel was too powerful to print. Like, they just had stuff way out of balance, and Randy kind of pushed them back towards, you know, what makes Magic work when you first start playing? It's, you know, more creature centric than that. So you can tell in his work in Invasion Block where the big dragons like Rith and things like that really stood out as figuring out how to make those cards work and make them be competitive. But for me, I don't know. I kind of took that and ran with it. I trying to be even cater to more types of players than Randy was. We're doing stuff like Commander, more casual stuff, more multiplayer stuff. Just understanding like why I got into the game. And for me, a lot of that was flavor. Just the flavor on the cards themselves and the sets themselves. Those early sets have tons of flavor. And I think after Ice Age, they kind of drifted away and became more mechanical. And it took until we got that back on track with M10 and Zendikar, I think. And it's been a lot more good mix of mechanics and flavor and storytelling since then, which I think hits kind of all players in a good space. And that's what I hope is my legacy, is that I brought resonance to the forefront of Magic design.
Could you also be known as the guy that brought creatures to the forefront of Magic design?
Like I said, I think Randy started that work. He really did. I don't want to take too much credit for that. I keep on it because I think it's right. It does a lot. When you first start playing, that's what you're attracted to, and that's why the game's fascinating to so many people. That's what they imagine it to be, is a battle of creatures, and I think that's what they want it to be, is a battle of creatures. And then as you get, you know, as you get more and more into it, there's this phase most players go through where they want to buck the trend and be the guy who doesn't play creatures and beats the guy who plays creatures and, you know, wipe up the floor with the guy who keeps wanting to play creatures. And that's fun for a while too, but at the end of the day, I want to cater to everyone's base desire for this game to be about fantasy creatures battling each other. And, you know, there'll be certainly fringe strategies. Sometimes they're very good. There's plenty of Sphinx's Revelation decks out there now that don't have any creatures in them at all, and that's fine. But that should not be the default best way to play the game at all times.
Right. So you know, you have all these big picture goals in mind, and you're kind of responsible for leading everyone to implement those. What's a typical day like for you? You know, you show up at the office. What does your day consist of?
It usually consists of about 6 hours worth of meetings, whether it's with people reporting up to me, set leads, giving me the download on where they're at and what problems they're running into and what decisions they're trying to make their sets work. My boss, the VP of R&D, or the executives of the company in general, just talking about performance and what we have coming up. I meet with organized play a lot because I'm very involved in decisions about the Pro Tour and the Pro Players Club and Grand Prix setup and all that stuff. Magic Online. And then everybody else in the company, like the sales team and the brand team. And then if I'm lucky, I'll get to play at Magic for an hour. And then other than that, I got to look through everybody's card sets, go look through all the artwork that's coming in, just trying to keep my hands on everything. We're doing so much stuff now that it can get overwhelming even for me. So I don't get to go too deep down into any one thing. I just got to try to make sure I'm keeping my hands in all the different products and programs that we're working on.
Right. Well, yeah, and I mean, with so much going on, you know, it's really important that you guys have, you know, the best people leading those and the right talent. How do you approach, how do you guys approach hiring, and just in the sense that how do you find the people you want to take the game in the right direction? What are you looking for in a candidate? Because obviously, you know, a lot of people out there, you have so many people make their own custom sets, all these people who would love to get a job as a designer at Wizards. You know, what are you looking for from people?
Generally, we're looking for someone with a more holistic view of the game than just what personally makes them happy to play. I think everybody kind of falls into that trap of, I personally, or my playgroup and I, wish X and Y were true. So I made a set where, you know, everything costs 3 or less. Or I made a set where there are no bad cards or whatever. Well, the last guy we just hired Adam Prozac, who, you know, played in the Star City circuit. He played on a couple of Pro Tours. He was a big-time F&M player and a writer. I love the guy because he's, you know, in touch with all sorts of different levels of players. He played in dozens of Friday Night Magics, and, you know, he would make sure to try and build his own decks and not net deck all the time. But at the same time, he can draft with the best of them and cube with the best of them and know what it takes to win those kind of things. So I want people with kind of a breadth of experience that can think about somebody other than themselves and what would make them happier? What would a new player think when he encountered this thing that I just invented? You know, you want to be able to step outside your own shoes. And at the same time though, hold on, my phone's ringing. Sorry about that. And at the same time though, you need to have some skills. We got a bunch of good players here and, we know that the best players in the world are going to be trying to break our game and find every mistake we made and exploit any little thing we left out, and we need to be able to prevent as much of that as we can.
Now, does your group just work on Magic the Gathering?
Yes. That's my purview is just Magic top to bottom. There are different people that we lend out to other projects here and there, whether it's Duel Masters or Dungeons & Dragons or whatnot, but in general I would say upwards of 95% of the man hours for people reporting to me is all on Magic.
Do you prefer it that way?
That's a good question. I guess I haven't known it many other ways. It's sometimes people go off and do work on other games and come back with some insight. But in general, whenever someone is, I'm lending their time to someone else, I'm just getting annoyed that, I'm not getting as much stuff done as I could be.
Right. Yeah. That's the downside to.
Yeah. I mean, everyone plays a lot of other games in their spare time, which is great. There's some board gaming going on at lunch and after work, and people are playing competitors' games at home in their free time, whatever. So we're trying to keep our eye on as much, you know, other stuff as possible to make sure we don't get too caught up in just ourselves. But in general, like I said, we are cranking on all cylinders. We got so many different cards and products coming out that everyone's constantly very busy, and it's hard for me to find time to let someone go work on something else.
But yeah, and I'm sure you guys are all, just over there, laughing to yourselves as the rest of the Magic world is going crazy over the half a Dak Faden from Conspiracy that was spoiled in the like detective-ish way they had to go find all of that.
Yeah.
Those are a lot of fun for us. I imagine they're even more fun for you guys watching people figure it out.
Yeah. Hats off to our community guys for coming up with that way of spoiling that card. That's a, really great way to interact with the community, and there's some smart people out there. You know, as soon as they saw a couple pieces of it, looking at some of the forums, and they kind of guessed most or all the card pretty close to correctly within just a few clues. So it's cool to watch people and see just, we know we're doing something right when people can guess, you know, what we're trying to capture, and they get it right for the most part.
Well, one of the things you guys, I think, would definitely have say you gotten right was Theros Block. Do you want to talk just, kind of in a big picture way, just about, where Theros took Magic after, coming back, you were returned to Ravnica, which is a set that was, very popular when it first came out, the original Ravnica, and you go into a new one with Theros. How is it, how happy are you guys with it now that we're entering the last set in the block?
Quite happy. It's been really successful, and it was definitely, we knew that kind of resonance flavor driven block could work because of Innistrad, and it was interesting to try to take a different swing with Greek mythology. We haven't done a large, small block structure in quite some time. That used to kind of be the way everything was done back in the day. Right. We haven't done one like that in a while, so it took some getting used to have to stretch that out across three sets, which is normally we're doing just two sets and then coming up with something new and different in the third slot, but we had to stretch this one out over three sets. I think it left one of the gods in kind of a not ideal situation because we knew we wanted to save a bunch of stuff for the end and we wanted to start off strong as well. So I think that there's a few complaints that Bourne felt a little lackluster, and I could see where those are coming from. We were just trying to pace things a certain way and maybe we didn't quite nail that. But other than that, I think the blocks worked out super well. It kind of takes some of the gameplay from Rise of the Eldrazi, that kind of
right.
Build up the battle cruiser, but not Rise kind of turned everything on its ear, and there's still a lot of very traditional ways to do things in Theros, which I like. It's just that the battle cruiser is just one way to play, and there's other different ways to play as well. But so the flavor's been great, and the reception's been very good.
Yeah, I've actually been a big fan of Theros Draft. Sealed, less so. It feels like there's too many synergies that need to go on for it to be there. But one thing I just haven't been happy with Theros, though, is the standard is just being dominated by Devotion. And we just coming off of, Ravnica, which was a awesome three-colored block. You had all this multicolored goodness goes in, and then now we got, two monocolored decks that are dominating standard. Is that something that you guys foresaw? Is that what you wanted to go with, or is it just nature of the beast?
It was, I mean, we don't ever, can't ever nail down exactly how things are going to turn out. I think in the case of this one, we wanted the new mechanics to matter. We definitely knew that Devotion was going to have a tough time standing out in a world where people were playing a bunch of gold cards, so we pushed some of the stuff pretty hard. I actually think the thing that tips the scales, though, was the inclusion of Mutavault in M14.
Yeah, definitely.
Which makes it, you know, not only it's a really hard card to play in a two- or three-color deck, but it just is such a free roll in the one-color decks that is so powerful. And I guess we hadn't identified that level of impact that card was going to have when combined with these monocolor strategies. Otherwise, we probably wouldn't have considered putting it in a set.
Now, yeah. Did you guys do a lot of testing with Theros, like, as a block within the context of just the cards within the block and potentially see that multicolored strategies were very viable? I think the most exciting card in the new set for me is the black-white god, Athreos.
Athreos.
So a lot of people are talking about brewing, building around that in like green, white, black or white, black and stuff like that. So is it sort of a situation where you guys knew what was coming in the later sets and you said, okay, Devotion's powerful now with just Theros, but once we add some more stuff later? Or was that just you really Mutavault kind of swung the scales too far?
Well, that's a tough question. I think we wanted all of the Devotion to be playable. I will say that I think Thassa ended up slightly better than we would have hoped. As you know, we're gonna guess how powerful each individual card is, and we're gonna be wrong in one direction or the other just based on, you know, factors that we didn't foresee or just kind of variance in general. But we were hoping that some of the other gods were going to enable more two-color Devotion decks. Like the ones in Born didn't quite get there, unfortunately. I think because we just didn't fully understand the difference between how much of a difference 5 and 7 was going to be in the Devotion that required to turn them on. And I think that we got closer to knowing that answer by the time we got to working on Journey into Nyx. So I do expect those gods will show up and do a lot more.
So, yeah, you know, I loved Devotion. You know, when the thing was based off of Chroma came out a couple years ago, it was kind of just when I was getting into playing. It was, oh, that's interesting. But it actually... Sorry. Guys.
No warning.
Yeah. You totally call, he's like, yeah, my dog's gonna bark, so don't worry, I'll be on it. I'll mute myself. That's my solution. I'll mute myself.
Except while I'm on the mic.
Hey, what if I'm halfway through asking a question?
I have been too. That was unfortunate timing. Sorry, guys.
Sorry, this is Corbin's last episode, so we thought we
That true?
Well, it is now.
So is that why Dayside, or how you say that?
Deicide.
Deicide. Was that why it was created? Because you thought you needed a release valve for the gods? Because I've heard a lot of complaints about this, that people were just saying that now it just seems like it's hard to play the gods in Standard. There's so much against it that this card kind of turns the tide against it.
I mean, I think in general, we're better off having the release valves than not. For instance, I think if you remember Fairies from Lorwyn block, where we didn't have any great answers, you know, Cloud Thresher was not good enough to stop them, and by the time we got Volcanic Fallout printed, they'd been dominant for a year. That we'd rather just put answers in the blocks themselves. The Creeping Corrosion was in Scars of Mirrodin block just in case, and Deicide is there kind of just in case. I mean, I don't think it's so easily main deckable if there aren't a lot of gods. I think that you'll be able to beat up on people playing too many Deicides if you don't have gods in your deck, and so then they won't be playing the Deicides, and there'll be this nice little dance going on. So, I mean, I hope that we didn't push that card to the point where no one's playing gods anymore. That is certainly not the goal of it. The goal is just if there are too many gods, it's easy to throw a couple of these in your sideboard. Like I said, I'd rather be in that world where there are answers available if things get out of hand, because, I mean, indestructible, cheap, gigantic enchantments are not the easiest things to get rid of. We gotta put some kind of not so subtle answers in people's hands. And at the same time, it plays up a pretty critical moment in the story, which we wanted to convey on the card. It's on the cards themselves somewhere. And that was a good opportunity to do that.
I agree with that, but what happens if the guys just never take off and they never become a major part of Standard?
Well, that would be unfortunate. We know people want them to be good. We know people are excited about them. But at the same time, we never have perfect information when we release a set, so we gotta take our best shot and hope that the whole thing works out the way we planned it.
And not all magic is standard. Like, even if the gods never get there in standard, that doesn't really matter to somebody like me who plays zero standard. I do play 10 of EDH. I see a card like Kruphix, I'm like, oh, I have to build a new deck, and this is going in three decks.
Cool.
Like, so the fact that the casual players are going to like the gods, both casual and competitive EDH players are going to like the gods, and that's something that's going to be like an Eldrazi or like a cool Dargon or Angel. It's going to be cool forever. So even if it never takes off in standard, putting those cards wasn't a waste.
No, I don't mean to imply that they're a waste. I know that people like them. I know when Theros first came out that everybody in the department here has some anecdote of being in a store with a little kid opening packs and just hoping that it's a god. They didn't even care which one. They just knew there were gods. They knew the gods were awesome and they wanted to get the gods. Yeah, I'm sure at the kitchen table and at Commander and things like that, that they're going to do their jobs. Well, it is ideal for us. We'd really try to get to a place where, the cards that the kitchen table players like are legitimate in constructed magic. Like, we want you to look at the deck list that people are playing at the Pro Tours and say, oh yeah, I like those cards. Those cards are sweet. Not like Necropotence and no creatures or whatever.
Yeah.
Not even know what's going on. Like, this doesn't look anything like the magic that I play. We're happier when Baneslayer Angel or Primeval Titan or Stormbreath Dragon or whatever, are the cards people are using to do well in tournaments, not necessarily win all the time, but to place highly in tournaments, because I think those are the cards that, like you said, the people who don't play competitive standard, latch onto, and when they look at our coverage or watch our events or when they think of playing in them themselves, that it's not going to be such a foreign experience to them.
Yeah, so, and I think the fact that Theros is such a top-down, the Greek mythology, contributes a lot to that. Can we expect this pretty much going forward? Is this how the thinking in R&D is we want all of our sets to be resonant like this, or will we see some more, return to other planes and stuff like that?
I think we're going to be leaning on the resonance thing a decent amount. More than we had previously. Like, Ravnica continues to work. I was actually, you asked about Return to Ravnica being successful and then going into Theros. I was more concerned about Return to Ravnica being successful than I was about Theros. I felt like Theros was, everyone that knows something about Greek mythology and will be excited to see some of that stuff play out in cards. But how rehashed was Ravnica going to feel? Or would people even care? Or is it just like, yes, it feels the same. I love it, and I think we did a good job of keeping the things that worked that were the same and switching it up enough that it felt different even if you played through it. So I was super happy that happened. So I think we're going to keep, there's not a ton of Gothic horror, Greek mythology type, where everybody knows the material resonant
right.
Settings. So we're going to deploy those carefully. We're going to try to find hooks that we can base sets around that might not be quite as deep and then put some cool mechanical stuff in with it as well. Resonance has certainly moved up a lot higher on the ingredient list for what we consider a successful block, though, in the last 3 to 4 years.
Well, nothing says resonance like a lightsaber. When we're going to see those?
Oh, we should get, put on the phone with Lucas and see what we can do there.
Hey, you guys are going to do a movie. You guys are going to be in the same league together. So
that's right. That's right. Now, one thing we're definitely proud of is that we have kept our intellectual property kind of to ourselves. We haven't ever sold out and made the Transformers card set or
all right.
Whatever, the DC Comics card set. That we've built a pretty decent set of worlds and characters that are our own, and I hope that this movie kind of, pays us off for all that hard work.
How did that even come about, the movie idea? It was just, it'd be somebody sitting around, it'd be really cool if we had a movie. I mean, because it's honestly just something I'd never even considered possible for Magic, but now that it's happening, I'm like, well, that's a great idea.
Well, I mean, from our end, we did, when we switched to the kind of Planeswalker model back in Lorwyn, where we just said the problem with our storytelling and why our storytelling might not be attractive to partners that want to do something with it, like make movies or TV shows or cartoons or whatever, is that every year is so different. It's hard to say any one thing is magic or looks like magic because we're in, Japanese world, and then the next set's in metal world, and then we're in city world, and none of the characters are the same, and it just didn't feel like we had a thing. So that's why we created Planeswalkers, was to give us a through line to tell stories using the same characters year after year. So that gave us the ability for somebody to latch onto. And then what I think it did was, just given enough time, people that played Magic back in the day or whatever got jobs in Hollywood. And just, we kind of had the feeling that if we could stick around long enough, where, you know, people that were big time into Magic kind of rose the ranks elsewhere in the world, whether it's, you know, the guy who runs Twitch TV is a Magic player, and people in different Hollywood studios are Magic players. It's just people that play Magic have kind of gotten up in the world, and we're starting to see that they want to take an interest in us, and it's great. So, and I think that's what happened. Just someone played Magic that worked for a production company and said, here's something that no one's done a movie about yet that I think would work. Let's try this. And, they got in touch with us, and it's been great.
I think Corbin might be showing kind of how new he is, because personally, I'm a little surprised to hear you say that about the storytelling pre, like, M10. But I think now that you have the Planeswalkers, I definitely see what you mean about carrying them through the different blocks. And, you know, we get a bunch of different Aljannis and a bunch of different Elspeths, and that's really neat. But for me personally, I've been ready for a movie since 1997, because the Tempest block felt, and the whole crew of the Weatherlight, yes, following those guys, that all felt so cinematic to me. I used to read Duelist Magazine.
Right.
They laid out how all the cards in Tempest,
yep,
kind of, you put them in sequence, and they kind of laid it all out and told about how that showed the whole story progressing. I thought that was just the coolest thing ever.
It was cool. In fact, yes, it's true that this is not the first time that we have tried that kind of cross-block, through-line storytelling. Mark Rosewater and some of the other guys back in those 97-ish years did that work with Gerard and Sisse and the Weatherlight crew. It did a lot of good things. I think they kind of overdid it. They jammed it on half the cards in the set, and people got sick of it. I think we're deploying the Planeswalkers a little more carefully, and those stories, so that you're not seeing Tangarth and Gerard on 25 cards in every set. And I don't know that the world was ready to make a Magic movie back then. Like, I don't think we had quite enough players. I don't think the technology was there. But now, and now the fantasy is so big with Lord of the Rings and Harry Potter and all that stuff having taken off, I think that it's proven that you can make those kind of movies now and that people will go see them.
Sure, back in 1997, people weren't sure if people would go to an X-Men movie.
Right.
So, now we know.
Yeah, and I think, you know, we're trying to position our Planeswalkers as kind of having that superhero vibe. So, you know, I think if we have a great recipe of fantasy meets superheroes, and let's hope that they can take something to do something with it.
And what if this does become successful? What are, like, I know there's some people that are cautious about this, that this could just ruin Magic, that we'll have all the Beaver fans in here and they just want Beaver cards. Do you see that as a potential? Or?
I don't want to think of anything as ruining Magic, so I'm not signing up for that. It's going to make us relook at some stuff. But at the end of the day, like, why did we get here and how did this all work? And why were they willing to make a movie? We can't throw that out once we get the movie. I do think we'll be able to make some products, and maybe they're not even cards. Maybe it's action figures. I don't know. For people who are just fans of the movie and aren't particularly interested in engaging in a trading card game, but I expect it'll bring in a whole bunch of people, that didn't know about us. And, you know, we want to stick with what worked. We really do. So I don't expect it to do anything about ruining Magic. Don't worry about it.
Real quick question. Are you going to take live-action shots from the movie and then put them in the Magic card frames, and that'll be the new set?
We haven't, it's going to be so many years for this movie to even exist that we haven't really dug into that. There will probably be a set, and I don't even know what that means, if it's a standard legal set or its own thing or in a box, like a board game that's based on the movie. But I don't know if we're going to do new paintings or, I don't know. We don't, no idea. What would be cool? Screenshots? Probably not.
No.
Illustrations based on the movie? Maybe that would work.
Yeah,
if you do cards with screenshots, the pack must have a stick of gum in it. I think that's
right.
The rule.
Star Wars cards from like 1978 or whatever.
I have a bunch of those in my living room.
Right.
So one last question as far as the movie goes before we move on. With this movie, obviously going in, you know that you have this player base of people who, you know, like you mentioned, are dedicated to it, and, you know, you don't want to ruin Magic for those people, but at the same time, you're trying to draw in this new crowd that knows, you know, maybe nothing about Magic. How do you really, I mean, what has been the focus of the movie? Is it aimed towards the people who are already playing, and then you're hoping to pick these new people up, or are you kind of throwing out the stuff that, you know, maybe keeps those people who already know about the game and stuff you know, coming to the movie in lieu of trying to draw in new players? Or is there just a balance that you guys are hoping to find?
Well, we don't, there's no script yet, so I don't know exactly what's, you know, what percentage of what is going into that. We gave a big download to the studio guys. All of it is our pre-existing stuff. Now, I'm going to assume that that they know how to do that balancing act, like take X-Men, keep the stuff that everyone who's been reading X-Men since the 70s or whatever knows and loves about the X-Men, but at the same time throw out the stuff that just doesn't work either as a movie in general or as a movie that a new someone new to the franchise would understand. And I expect they'll probably do that same balancing act for us. I mean, we are not making a 100% faithful historical, you know, of our past canon. If stuff needs to change to make the movie work, we're going to allow that to happen. But at the same time, like, there's a reason they want to make a movie out of magic, and it's because stuff we've been doing is working and has been popular and people like it. And so I expect that they're going to keep as much of that as they can feasibly do in a story that makes sense for them.
As long as it's not another Dungeons and Dragons movie, I think we'll go see it.
Yeah, jeez. My brother and I saw that in theater. Well, I probably shouldn't say anything like that. I do work for Wizards of the Coast, so we'll leave it at that. But.
Well, you can say that you learned from that experience.
Sure, we learned from that experience.
It feels like this movie may be like the next big, you know, driver of interest. Those are the Planeswalkers really brought people in over the last few years. What's it been like from your seat just seeing this growth? And, you know, where is most of that growth coming from? Is it coming from, you know, the players who want to travel around the country and play in Grand Prix? Or is it coming from, you know, those people sitting at home slinging angels back and forth the table? You know, because Magic's been growing at a crazy rate the last few years. So what's it just been like from your end watching all of it happen?
Tremendous. It's been awesome. I think there's been proportionate growth in kind of both of those groups you're talking about. That said, there's way more people at the kitchen table slinging angels than there are globetrotting to play in Grand Prix. But we've tried to make, you know, all parts of that spectrum more attractive than what they were a few years ago. A lot of it's been, I think we're cross-generational now, that, you know, dads are getting their kids to play, or you know, moms are getting their sons to play with them. And we've just been trying to make it more engaging everywhere we can. We've done a lot of work to make the game itself more accessible, like you said, through duels, or like I said earlier, through resonance. And we've kind of streamlined some of the gameplay stuff away from the crazier nonsense we were doing in the Time Spiral block and whatnot. And we've really doubled down on our involvement with game stores. We know that that's where the communities are born, and where people can go and enjoy our game and be around people that think and act like them. And we know that's a big deal for people that enjoy our game. And like I said as well, that gaming and fantasy are just huge now. So we're really capitalizing on that. There's a big wave of movies and TV and things like Twitch TV, putting gaming more into the mainstream, and the tabletop board game show and things like that. The kind of culture that we exist in has gone more mainstream than it did when I first started playing Magic. So a lot of stuff's going our way. It's a lot of it's our own doing. There's some stuff that we're just in the right place at the right time, but it's all working out tremendously well for us.
What are some of the challenges you face? You know, obviously whatever they are, they're good problems to have, but what are the challenges of a game growing so rapidly?
Well, we have the same problem that we've had forever, which is balancing the needs of the enfranchised long-term player with the guy who is just starting out or just might want to check out your game. And it's always difficult to balance those. I mean, because one guy is a sure thing, and if you make the guy who's been playing for 7 years happy with the 30th set of cards that he's going to buy, then, you know, you know what he's going to do. He's going to buy, he's going to draft it, he's going to play. But at the same time, people leave for whatever reason. Sometimes it's because we pissed them off, and sometimes it's because their life changed, and we have to be able to keep adding players in. We want to have a robust, growing community, and so we have to try to make sure, what are we doing that's relevant to the new gamer? There's people out there that have just played a bunch of video games, and our game's super hard to learn if you're used to just video game tutorials as your way of learning games. And what can we do to help that guy want to get into this? And then you got to mix them all up and put them in the same product. Theros has to do both of those things: keep the enfranchised, engaged guy around more, and be appealing to someone who's never played before. And that is, you know, it's been a tough thing to balance for all these years.
So Duels of the Planeswalkers has actually been very good at getting people back into Magic, new people into Magic. It's been a great gateway drug, you can say.
Yes, it's been great for that.
It's personally embarrassing how much better Duels of the Planeswalkers taught my wife to play Magic than I taught her. Like, I couldn't do as thorough a job as that game, and I thought it was a little embarrassing. I'm like, I've played this game since 96. I know what's going on. She was asking questions. I was like, well, let's not get to that yet. For whatever reason, the order Duels does everything in is just, it's absolutely perfect for teaching a new person.
Well, thank you. That's really good to hear. We've done some studies about how people learn and if they do better if a friend teaches them versus if they learn from Duels. And they're actually pretty analogous. They do both, they both blow away trying to learn from reading the rules by yourself. I mean, that's almost a sure recipe to disaster is sitting down with a rule book or an insert by yourself, not knowing how to play. Funny enough, that's how I learned how to play.
Me too. I thought I learned how to play. That was a magic that I was playing.
Right.
But I thought you had to tap every land for mana every turn, and that's why cards like Power Surge and Psychic Venom were good. So that was the result of reading the rule book for me.
Right. It's just, it's impossible to, I mean, Duels teaches you things in the order when they're relevant, like when they're happening. If you're reading a rule book, you're just reading everything and not knowing where to look if something comes up. But anyway, right. Duels is kind of like that friend who knows how to teach you how to play and does a good job for that. And it just lets you do it at your own pace and in the solitude of your own home without somebody breathing down your neck or laughing at you. And that's a huge deal for people that might be, you know, insecure or you know, don't want to lose in public or look like they don't know what they're doing. Duels lets you get all that out of your system.
Yeah. The next step to Duels though is Magic Online. And me, myself, I'm thoroughly invested in Magic Online. I'm waiting for Vintage Masters eagerly. I got all my legacy cards ready to go, but people are complaining about the gap and, to get someone to come in and play Duels of the Planeswalkers and get to Modo. And a lot of people that make that jump, they are let down by the experience that they get from Modo. What are you guys' focus on Modo and bringing into new players into Modo and trying to make it as, you know, relevant in the 2014?
Well, it's been a long process and it's been a ton of work and I know where you're coming from. We're trying to tackle some infrastructure and stability issues with this new client that we're developing. We're about there. It's coming along nicely. It's been a long road to hoe, but we're getting it where we want to, and then we're going to start on some future development that's going to do exactly those things that you're talking about. I mean, believe me, we are hyper aware of what else is going on out there in the marketplace, what our competition's doing, what their offerings are like, you know, how they're doing some stuff better than we are, and how, you know, we're doing some stuff better than they are, but, you know, the heat's definitely turned up on Magic Online, and we're aware of that, and we want to get stuff like leagues back in place and other things for it. So we've never actually actively marketed Magic Online because we're always afraid that we're going to, you know, hit a user capacity that we can't sustain because we're always worried about butting up against a maximum number of people online at a time. But I think we're going to have a system now that can finally scale up to handle as many people as we can throw at it as we want. And we can actually put some real effort into getting new players into it and make some offerings for them to help them, you know, help that become as robust as our paper community has been.
How do you guys view Magic Online just in the larger sense of the game? You know, is it, you know, obviously more and more people, they move from paper to online, because they don't have time to get on Friday nights or whatever. Right. You know, how do you guys view that? I mean, is it in the next 20 years of Magic, do you ever see something where, you know, online becomes bigger than paper, or is that something you guys, you know, what's your take on that?
So right now it is, it exists for people that A, want to play more than what they can do in paper. You know, a lot of practicing for big events and stuff like that happens on Magic Online, or people for whom who can't, they just, whether they have a job or a family or whatever, and they want to keep playing and it just doesn't make sense for them to go to a store or drive to a bunch of tournaments. So it's for people that, you know, kind of have been through the paper life cycle and are now wanting to move online. But I do think that there will be opportunity for us to have people go, like you said, straight from Duels into Mitko, or their first step into Magic is Magic Online. That's really not true for too high of a percentage of players now. As for will it be bigger than paper, a few years ago, I think we would have all said yes, and that's definitely the future is digital gaming, and we can really give you a great experience playing our game there. The rules are all handled. Your collection's handled. It's great. But as we invested more in stores, you know, starting in the 2009-ish time period, that we see that that face-to-face camaraderie and that community building is such a huge part of why Magic works as a game. Just finding your friends and hanging out, you know, just when you lose, the fact that you can go outside and, you know, grab a smoke and talk to your buddies about what happened and you feel better about it just from having done that. Where on Magic Online, you don't get that, you know, or digital games in general. You don't have that kind of pat on the back or let me check your deck out and tell you how, what I would have done differently or whatever. That just makes you feel so much more invested and like part of something bigger. We're going to try to add some of that stuff in. I think most digital games want to get that sense of camaraderie or that sense of connectedness with other players, and we do as well. But I think for now that face-to-face does that so well, and we've just seen there's so many options out there now for people to play video games that do everything, you know, whether it's first-person shooters or MOBAs or MMOs or whatever. Like, you could spend your whole life sitting in front of your screen being entertained, but yet they still want to play Magic in the store or in their kitchen or whatever, or at a huge convention hall. And, you know, we're aware of that. We think it's awesome. I think it's awesome. That's what made me enjoy it so much. And, you know, I think we want to keep going with that. It's working. It's been working, and it's going to continue to work.
Yeah, we were talking about that a few weeks ago. That's exactly why, you know, there's video games from 10 years ago that now nobody knows anything about. It's the fact that, the community stays along way after maybe the game itself kind of fades. You know, not that Magic fades, but that you do go through periods where, you know, you're not as into the game or you have a bad night. But it's, you know, having your friends there that keeps you coming back. And that's I'm on the side that I think, you know, online could never replace paper, just because of that reason.
And one thing though with paper, that, you know, a lot of people play paper Magic, they want to try Magic Online, but mm-hmm. the thought of having two collections is just, you know, too much for them. And one thing I've heard thrown around that is a little controversial is like a subscription to access to cards. Is that something you guys ever considered? Is that something that could just never happen, could never work?
I won't say that it could never happen. We have considered that and quite a few other models as well. I do think we want to tackle accessibility soon on Magic Online. It is true that if you do play paper, that Magic Online asks you to, you know, reacquire that same standard deck that you had already gotten in paper. And that is a tough pill for some people to swallow. And we're looking at ways to, how can we alleviate that without, you know, disrupting the whole way the cards work and the economy online works. We're looking at all sorts of other games. We're looking at talking amongst ourselves about better ways to make that feasible for people. We got some other problems to solve in the short term, but if Magic Online is going to stay around and stay relevant, which is absolutely our goal, we are going to have to kind of open up our bag of tricks a little bit more.
Right.
One format you tried to make relevant was Modern, and you did this in a big way was with Modern Masters. This brought a lot of new cards, or brought back a lot of cards that people had accessibility problems getting to. And I remember we talked to you about this at Gen Con. This was when Modern Masters was announced, and you were concerned that this was going to be Chronicles 2.0, and you didn't want to go down that path. You guys were trying to make sure that that didn't happen. And now that we're at the point now with Modern Masters that it actually we're back to the same accessibility problems that we had, say, a year ago. How was Modern Masters successful for you, and what are you going to look forward to in the future with these reprint sets?
Well, yeah, Modern has taken off in a huge way. Really happy that that's true. We didn't know how people were going to react to it when we first made it. And then once it took off a little bit, we announced Modern Masters because we did see that, some of these cards were super hard to get your hands on. But yes, we did not want to, make people, you know, kind of lose faith in the system that we were just going to randomly dump tons and tons and tons of cards into the system that they had spent a lot of time and effort trying to collect over time. So we were very conservative with how much Modern Masters we made, and that was the right call. Like you said, Chronicles was the opposite of that. Chronicles was very flippant and very crazy with the number of cards that they reprinted, and we didn't want to do that. And in fact, I think what ended up happening with Modern Masters was instead of kind of easing the supply problem, it created more demand. I think people saw that we were willing to reprint those cards, or that maybe that they bought some packs and now felt like they had a few pieces to start working on their own modern decks, and suddenly more and more people are playing modern. It kind of tripled in the past year, the amount of sanctioned modern that has been played. So it is on an incredibly fast trajectory, and we are definitely looking at ways to try to keep up with that demand. We said we would reprint the cards. I think we kind of executed it the first time well. It didn't freak anybody out once it was all said and done. More people are playing the format than ever before, so I imagine we're going to look at some more ways to keep doing that.
So you had another reprints. One was definitely Thoughtseize, that one that I was talking with some other people about. You know, Thoughtseize was a card that was hard to get in Lorwyn. Mm-hmm. And you guys reprinted in Theros. Was that ever in Modern Masters and then you pushed it to Theros because it fit there, or was it originally in Theros and you were just trying to find cards to reprint?
It was on the list of stuff that was in consideration for Modern Masters, for sure. Eric Lauer, the lead developer for Theros, put it into Theros specifically because, just as we said earlier, we had a cycle of very powerful, indestructible enchantments, and black would not have an easy time dealing with that once they hit the table. And so, you know, we're trying to look at ways to bring back old cards people like and answer the problems that need answered in the format, and this seemed like a good marriage. Unfortunately, the card is super nutso powerful, and I think people are pretty tired of it by this point. But I think we tried it in good faith, and that's why it's in there. Certainly could have been in Modern Masters, but we thought Theros would have been a better spot for it.
So are you wary about these reprints? Like, you're seeing Thoughtseize, and now Mutavault is a major dominant force in Standard. Are you wary about these reprints that need to be in Modern, but now are going to impact Standard too much?
Well, those two in particular have certainly made us, you know, sit up in our chairs a little bit. There's been a bunch of stuff like Nantuko Shade, though, that we've reprinted that did nothing, basically. No one even played it. And we don't want – I don't think that's particularly satisfying for people either. It's like your favorite card got reprinted, and it's bad now. And Lightning Bolt was awesome. It did its job. So, you know, it's kind of hit or miss. It's not necessarily true that we're putting them in Standard sets just to make them more available for Modern. I think we have other ways to do that if that's the problem we're trying to solve. We have a huge backlist of cool cards. If people like them, let's let them play with them again. And Thoughtseize and Mutavault probably went over the line, and some of the other ones have gone way under the line. I think, in general, we're going to keep trying to find cool reprints to put back into Standard. I guess we will do even more diligence to make sure that we end up with something that people are happy with at the end of the day, though.
So what can you tell us, if anything, about Modern Masters 2? Is it planned? Is it going to happen?
Modern Masters 2?
Yes.
It's something we talk about. I don't have any information that I can share about whether or not it's happening or whatever, but I mean, it will be hard not to talk about it based on the way the first one was received, so.
Right. Well, I mean, I know we all went to the Grand Prix in Vegas for it, and it was, you know, probably just the craziest, most awesome weekend ever. And Modern Masters, at least from the four of us, we're going to say it was a big success, so.
Yeah, that Grand Prix was far beyond my expectations.
It just blew up.
Yeah.
I think you very famously said you expected, was it Richmond, I think, that was around that time to be bigger because of the team format and its East Coast location?
Yeah. Yeah. Yep.
All very solid logic.
I know. Yeah. It just, I guess just the idea of getting your hands on something that was hard to get your hands on in a one-time only event, and the location didn't hurt either. It was a big deal.
Hey, Vegas. Fair enough. That helps a lot of people.
Real quick, while we're on the topic of things that are hard to get your hands on and such, and talking about reprints, I know, you know, the reserve list has always been something that's been on people's mind, especially in our community, and just curious what, you know, Wizard's stance is still on the reserve list, and if that's something that's, you know, been looked at any point.
Yeah, I mean, the reserve list is real, and it is here to stay. You know, people in the building have different opinions on whether or not that's something that they personally would like to see, but as a business, it is something we are committed to. In fact, that's what led us to create the modern format, was to be, you know, not tied down in that particular case with what we can reprint. So
absolutely.
There's those cards out there. I don't know what it is. A couple hundred cards that we have promised not to reprint. We're sticking by that. We kind of doubled down on that, strengthened the language in that a little bit. So you know, those are cards. There's a finite number of those cards out there, and, you know, if people want to go out of their way to collect those, they're about as sure bet as it can be. And for the rest of it, we're going to do our best to manage, you know, what we need to print to make a good play environment.
Excellent.
Hear that, guys? My pick of the week is Sentinel Hierophants.
What's that guy, like the 3-2 green guy that...
I think he has like Echo and Shroud or something like that. It's whatever Centaur from Urza's Saga is on the reserve list. Or Sentinel Centaurs or
Sentinel
something.
Sentinel, the 6-3 Echo guy, yeah.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
Yeah, the reserve list is, I mean, obviously there's stuff like Power 9 and Dual Lands and some of that early Arabian Nights stuff that makes a lot of sense, but you look at some of that stuff from Tempest and Urza's Saga block, and why that some of those cards are on that list is beyond me.
Yeah.
I personally would love to print tons more Deranged Hermits, but that isn't going to happen.
More Dual Lands. So, like, Dual Lands, honestly, are the biggest, I think, problem going on. But as far as, like, reprints, like, hey, I know you guys wish you could print Dual Lands because eventually, like, Legacy will get choked off just as, you know, the cards.
I don't want to say Legacy will get choked off. Like, I believe it'll stay this at least the size it is now. There's not that, when you look at Legacy, winning Legacy deck list, there's not that many cards in those decks that are on the reserve list. Right. And at the end of the day, someone's going to buckle and start playing Hallowed Fountain in their decks, you know?
Yeah. I mean, absolutely.
Maybe people even start winning tournaments with that. Depends on how tough those Tundras are to come by.
Helps you beat Cho.
Yeah, and I mean, you also have the online.
Yeah. I saw somebody was playing Glacial Fortress. I was like, that's genius.
Yeah, Mystic Gates. Yeah, I've seen these cards show up from time to time.
Yeah, and I mean, with the online format, especially with Vintage Masters coming out stuff, you're obviously showing the support for that, you know, older community and those people who do want to play those formats still in some capacity. And I think that's a great kind of resolve between the two because, you know, you can't print them in real life, but yet people who want to play these formats and want to experience them are still able to have that chance.
Right. I think the Vintage community could be very strong on Magic Online, you know, where you don't have to worry about anything happening to your Black Lotus if you leave the house with it or whatever, and, you know, just that the cards will be there.
Yeah. I'm just saying, I'm looking really forward to Vintage Masters. I've been waiting to play with Moxes pretty much my entire life, so I now get the chance to do that.
I've drafted it in-house. It's been a blast, so I hope you guys like it.
Do you got anything you could tell us about it?
It's
a blast.
It's going to be a blast. I remember the last time I played with it against Adam Prozac, he cast Ancestral Recall on himself, and then I killed him on the next turn with one card left in my library.
Oh, nice.
He'd forgotten he could cast it on me.
It's been a while since I read that card.
Yeah, right. Ancestral, it's for drawing 3. Or not.
So, you know, all the talk about, you know, the reserve list and modern and aside, how do you like to spend your time playing Magic? I know you said you get, you know, a couple hours a week to maybe play test. Is that, you know, how do you like to play your Magic now that you are in the position you're in?
I still love to draft. I do that every chance I get. I got a whole bunch of Commander decks. We play that every Friday afternoon, or people here play it every Friday afternoon. I only get down there once in a while. And I'll screw around and play in the casual only room or whatever it's called on Magic Online, just building whatever wacky thing catches my eye. And then someone's got a cube in-house every now and again, I'll do that. So all kind of stuff, the whole gamut of experiences. But I guess if I had to just play one way, it would probably be draft.
Yeah, well, I think that's
excellent
a lot. So we get to Conspiracy. I'm really looking forward to, you know, some of the draft only cards and that's going to be fun.
Yeah, it is a unique product. It was a lot of fun to work on, a lot of challenges, but, you'll see as we roll out our plans of showing off what's in there, just what a crazy, crazy way to play that's going to end up being.
Big question is fetch lands. There, people are complaining about these in modern and you did such a great job with the Shocklands reprints that the availability is everywhere. People can't complain about getting their Shocklands. If you don't have your Shocklands, you're not prepared for the format. But Fetchlands, people didn't quite see that. Is the same thing for you guys? Did you not see this happening, the demand of Modern? And eventually, I'm sure that we're going to get one. You don't want to say when, but is this a concern for you guys?
Yeah. I mean, they did take off kind of out of the blue, felt like, pretty recently. And obviously our turnaround time on doing anything is not instantaneous. So, any plans that we have to put more fetch lands out there will take some time to execute on, but we're definitely aware of, you know, what cards people need to build decks to play modern and, what cards they're after. So we're going to do what we can.
All right.
Absolutely. Well, I think that's really everything we had. So Aaron, thank you so much for coming on. Is there anything else that, you know, I know we've just been firing a lot of questions at you. Is there anything just, you know, you want to tell all the people who are following you and, you know, always want to hear what you have to say?
Geez. Follow me on Twitter at MTG Aaron. Been known to say a few things that, on there that get me in trouble from time to time, but.
I love it.
That's
keep
the way
doing
social
it.
Media works, I guess. No, just so we got a bunch of really smart, passionate people here that love Magic. And we got years of good plans down, coming down the road, both for our paper sets and our digital stuff. The game's in great hands, you know, not counting myself. Everybody else here is super smart and passionate. And you know, it's been a great ride watching Magic grow the way it has, and we're just going to keep at it. So we're really pleased that everyone's playing as much as they are and enjoying the product, and guys like you are creating content for it. It's awesome watching the community grow the way it has.
Thank you. I cannot express how much I love this game. I really don't play any other games. So, keep doing what you're doing.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for joining us. We are honored that you came on, and we'd hope to see you again sometime.
No problem.
And this is Brainstorm Brewery. Check us out next week, and we should have Zach Hill as a guest. So that should be fun.
Brainstorm Brewery is brought to you by GatheringMagic.com and CoolStuffInc.com. Show your support.